This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
In the style of a civilian occupation, Cities Without Citizens sought to articulate what a city is, what constitutes the borders of a city, and what the relationship is between a city and all the inhabitants, which are perhaps granted protections or protections are withholded from them. And it was with those sorts of questions in mind that Eduardo and I had wanted to organize this event tonight. And they were motivated by two issues. One, how have our cities evolved into the spaces that they have, and how could they be more hospitable, and how could we render them more hospitable going forward? I wanted to briefly read from Sharon Rotbard's preface to A Civilian Occupation. I thought it framed the project productively. He wrote, the questions posed by a civilian occupation should be considered in a broader context. What is the role of politics within architecture, and what is the role of architecture within politics? The local debate initiated by Weitzman and Siegel should help generate new thinking on architecture, urbanism, and politics. The politics of Israeli architecture is the politics of any architecture, end quote. Against the grain of the press notices that accompanied tonight's event, I invite you to constructively respond to their presentation. As with the other projects that we've organized here this year and in past years, we really believe that discursivity, that public dialogue and exchange is a way to move forward. And so we don't see this as a project that fans ideological politics and antagonisms, but really as a constructive way of working concepts out in a new direction. As to formal introductions, Ayel Weitzman and Rafi Siegel established their practice in Tel Aviv in 2000. Their office attempts to integrate architectural projects with research and writing. Among their recent works are the redesign of the Ashdod Museum of Art, a set design for Electra, and this exhibition and publication, A Civilian Occupation. Rafi worked together with Zvi Hecker on the design of the Palmach History Museum, built in Tel Aviv, and Ayel is developing his Politics of Verticality project into a book and a film. So again, I want to welcome Rafi and Ayel to Philadelphia.
Thank you, Aaron, and thank you very much for coming. I think the introduction put the project a little bit in context, but today what we want to do is to broaden a little bit the research as it was presented in a civilian occupation, and to integrate some new projects on it. So it will be a kind of a mix between The Mountain that Rafi and I wrote for Civilian Occupation, and another article I wrote called The Geometry of Occupation in another context. And we'll be dealing, therefore, with two issues. Yeah, if a civilian occupation very much deals with the politics of architecture, the politics of Israeli architecture, and as Aaron said, perhaps can be understood or transferred to politics of other architectures in other places. The other work that is going to be presented here today is speaking about the architecture of politics, meaning can we understand politics as a spatial construct? Can we understand the way that politicians operate as a kind of a constructive practice, destructive and constructive, that kind of manifests itself in space? And I think that you would perhaps join us in accepting that that premise. So initially what we want to show you here is a very abstracted image of a part of the West Bank. And you see a variety of forms and a variety of kind of formal and color arrangements that are actually different legal realities. No? We think that the situation, the condition of the frontier is probably best defined as encapsulating or containing within a limited area different legal realities and borders that are constantly in a situation of flux and change. If that would be a slide of a section of a nation state, that slide would be just one color, right? I mean, we're talking here about 15 kilometers square. And then ask the question whether the barrier that is built through the West Bank now is our, kind of the Israeli equivalent to the American closing of the frontier. Is it finally that we have a linear border that would separate between Israel and Palestine? And we would claim that it's not like that, that we cannot understand that, although the iconography of the barrier, when we see those fences, when we see those walls, it makes us think of a border, but the definition and the nature of a border is quite different than what is happening there. I want to start that the story that we're going to tell you today with an interesting moment in Israeli spatial politics. And we hear in this slide in 1972, it's, what is that, 5 years after the occupation in 1967, 1 year before the 73 Yom Kippur War. A little bit for orientation, I'm sure it's not very necessary, but this is Israel within its internationally recognized borders. Here we see the West Bank, the Sinai Desert, and the Golan Heights that were occupied in 1967. That moment is interesting here because there is a collision between two spatial paradigms within Zionism, right? We have here, as a young and handsome general, Ariel Sharon. He's the commander of the Southern Front. And that old man is David Ben-Gurion, right? That moment is a moment where Sharon takes initiative as a spatial designer, here in his capacity as a military general. But we have to understand that although in Israeli history the frontier is always very, very apparent, no? Before the state, the idea of expansion, the idea of networks, etc. When the state was created, labor traditionally acted according to a spatial paradigm that sought to fix the borders. Therefore, the main planner of the state, the architect of Zionism, of early Zionism, David Ben-Gurion, was using kibbutzim, moshavim, agricultural cooperative settlements to mark out the borders of the state. No? This is how he kind of redefined and wanted to protect it. He called it the organic wall. That issue came again after the occupation in 1967. Now imagine that Israel had very, very bizarre, it perceived its own borders as bizarre. No? The green line, which is between Israel and the West Bank here, is a very arbitrary, contrived ceasefire line. No, I mean you can. It doesn't attach itself to anything on the landscape. It just cuts through hills and valleys, etc. But when Israeli forces stopped progressing in 6 Days' War, they stopped along natural borders. Right? We have here the Jordan River, we have here the Suez Canal, and here the mountain range in the Bashan, in the Golan. And those borders started resonating with a kind of fantasmagorical attitude of the Israeli state, and it's seeking for the biblical borders, right, from the sea to the river. It was a border that could be understood in biblical conceptual terms. And initially, the instinct of the labor governments that were, actually, you know that the first 10 years of occupation were done under Israeli labor government, was to fortify the edge, the very edge. No? So there was what is called the Bar-Lev line, which is what you see here, which was a huge system of artificial landscape that would push all the way to the canal and piled there as one long sort of dike, earth dike, on the water edge, supposing to stop the Egyptians from gaining a foothold on the eastern Israeli side of the Suez Canal. Whereas Sharon, at that moment, what he's explaining here to Ben-Gurion, is that linear systems, linear spatial systems do not work anymore, right? And there's a whole kind of debate within military history between linear fortification and matrix fortification. And what Sharon claims here is that you cannot win a battle on the outer line. That the advantage of the Israeli military and of any sort of technologically progressed army is its dynamic capability, its ability to for what is called battle of movement and fire, right? Therefore, what he recommends is dismantling the line and constructing the whole depth of the Sinai Desert, a matrix of strongholds, right? It would be connected between them by roads and electromagnetic communication, and it will be a flexible system of defense, a flexible, dynamic, and aggressive system of defense that I will show you later. Here, just to explain things that perhaps are clear, during the first 10 years of the Israeli occupation of the West Bank, Labor constructed a series of kibbutzim and moshavim along the Jordan River. It was the same thing what the Barlev line was for the Sinai Desert, the Alon plan, this is the Alon plan, which is the Labor Party plan, was for the West Bank, right? Fortifying the water line. You'd see a kind of a sequence, of a linear sequence of moshavim. Their fields are interlocking. If there is an invasion from the east of Jordanian-Iraqi coalition, this is what was feared at the time, they would flood it and they would create a linear system of defense. I mean, we were speaking a little bit before about that, the idea of linear defense. And there was a similar debate in the high command of the Wehrmacht at the time. Here you see the Western Wall. The very famous Todt line, I'm sure you know about it, where Rommel was actually realizing the only way he could beat an ally invasion is on the waterline. If they would gain one foothold beyond it, they would be the Wehrmacht would have no ability to defend France. Here again, a series of famous French fortifications along the Maginot line. The fate of linear fortification is either they manage to hold the enemy, but most likely the linear fortification are designed psychologically to deter the enemy from actually contemplating an invasion. Therefore, the Maginot Line was never attacked. The German attacked kind of bypassed it from the north. Whereas the Todt Line, the ally realized if they poke linear fortification, even in one point, the whole length is immediately rendered useless. No. So this is what Sharon constructed. No, and it's a very important. And you will excuse me for explaining it in much detail because it's a very important moment in a spatial understanding of Israel that was later translated almost literally to the settlement policy in the West Bank. So we see here. This is the Suez Canal, right? This is the Suez Canal. This is what Labor General Barlev was constructing along at the dikes, right? Sharon took over the southern front and started building those strongholds, right? This is the matrix. It was non-contiguous, right? And all these roads that were connecting between them. On the 6th of October 1973, within a few hours, the Egyptian used a very simple trick to break the Barlev line that was otherwise perceived completely indestructible. No? I mean, the Russians advised the Egyptians to have even a tactical nuclear explosion to break through it. But the Egyptian who built just a few years earlier the Aswan Dam had water cannons, you know, high-pressure water cannons, within which they just melted the Barlev line into pools of mud and managed to position about 200,000 soldiers, two full Egyptian armies, on the other side of the canal within hours, right? At that day, the idea of linear fortification was dead. The idea of lines, of that perception of space was dead in Israel, right? Sharon, obviously, you know, kind of, he almost always fought the Barlev line. He fought Barlev. Barlev was the representation of the par excellence labor general, No, he was later became a minister. Sharon was, his hateful belief was such that he actually broke traditional ranks and joined the Conservative Party. And here they are, a few days after the break of the Balev line. Balev is, although with a cigar in his mouth, is, you know, he doesn't know what's... And you see Sharon here taking control. He's on the map. He's directing the battle, right? When the Egyptians enter his matrix, they had to stop, no? I mean, they could never get through it. They lost... about 400 tanks in one day on the 14th of October when they actually attempted to enter Sharon matrix. It had such an incredible firepower and such incredible versatility in engaging the Egyptian tanks. Here is Moshe Dayan. Sharon takes control. From that moment on, the space is the way that he imagined space. No? And this is what he's doing, and again, forgive us for the long-winded explanation. This is where you saw before the matrix was. The Egyptians were just redeploying here on the other side of the Suez Canal. Not only he, after the 14th, yeah, here we're talking about 15, 17, after in the 14th, the Egyptians lost so much of their armor to Sharon's matrix, he actually manages, he uses it in order to channel soldiers very rapidly, not to confront the Egyptians along their lines, but to break it and to actually to make a maneuver around. So he breaks now the Suez Canal to the other side. Instead of confronting the Egyptians face to face, he goes behind them, right? Breaking that and actually trapping half of the Egyptian army within Sinai. That was the kind of the ceasefire after the Yom Kippur War. Is very bizarre. If they started the war where each army was on one side of the canal, it ended where each army was on the other side of the canal, right? So that much for linear fortification. Yeah? That picture that Sharon was very lucky to get with his slight wound that earned him this famous bandage was became the sort of... how do you say, the election poster of the Likud. That thing got the Likud into power in 1977. The labor was in ruin. Golda Meir was old. Dayan seemed incapable. We had another government later of Rabin, but finally it was, the perception was that the right wing in Israel had the better, more original, more vital ideas. And Ariel Sharon became the minister in charge of settlements. Right? He wanted to become the Minister of Defense. He got the Minister of Agriculture, but he took the Committee for the Design of Settlements into it. And what he did from that moment on was replay the Yom Kippur War on the West Bank. Right? So instead of this linear fortification, and this is now the map of the West Bank, he's going to build his matrix of strongholds, of eyes, just like those... linear fortification in the Sinai were observation points. He's going to seed them through the West Bank. Here is explaining Caspar Weinberger, you probably remember him. They're sitting on a rocky hill in the West Bank, and he's explaining how he's actually moving settlements as battalions. No, I mean, we're having a kind of an urban warfare where the war is not in the city, it's by urbanism. No, we have tanks, homes like tanks across fields of operation. And if you remember this slide before of the Alon plan, and the more or less, you know, even though we have encroachment, even though we have, Israel wants to grab that land, and I'm not saying here in any way labor is better than Likud. We're just speaking about different spatial perceptions. If that is how the labor... plan looks like, this is how the Likud one looks like, right? There's no inside and outside, there's no Israel and Palestine, there is a mess, there's the frontier again. We're building in between Palestinian towns, we're using basically the matrix. Now a little bit about how kind of our intervention in that project started. It started through a human rights report I co-authored with the human rights organization B'Tselem. And the premise was that what we need to do was to change a little bit, because it was already changing, no? But to change a little bit more the discussion and the critique of Israeli left of the settlements from the principle to the spatial, right? So if peace now, I mean, basically, this is the premise of this land grab project. It's basically a critique, a kind of a debate within the Israeli left. No, peace now based their critique of Israeli settlement on the Fourth Geneva Convention, Article 49, an occupying country may not transfer parts of its population into an area it occupies. No, what we're talking about is a critique of settlement in principle. Right? Every settlement crossing 1 meter across the green line, it's in violation of Article 49. It's a war crime. Finished. Right? Now, we said this is only a part of the story. Actually, human rights are violated exactly because we are using settlements as paramilitary device. No? Therefore, the critique in principle is not enough. And what we need to develop is another tool, another map. If the Peace Now map shows Palestinian towns here in red dots and Israeli settlements in blue dots, it shows the location, right? They're not interested in form. They're not interested in how things are laid out across the terrain. They don't even understand it. It doesn't matter. What matters is how many citizens. And here you see that, and you see there's so many more red, meaning so many more Palestinians in the West Bank than there are Israelis. No? But when you look at space, the picture kind of reverses. And when you see that Israeli settlements are those blue stains on the map, you see how much more blue there is in relation to the population. And the beginning of the analysis is how that blue functions as a weapon, basically. So the analysis that was done by that map and in that report was about urban forms. You know? So we were looking at groups of settlements and asking ourselves why they're laid out like that. Why? I mean, if there are architects here, they would see that this is not very particular, very common forms for suburban planning, but there are other considerations here. No? And we were trying to look, what are those considerations? How we can, you know, sort of take the start from the map, by layout of things, and understand through them the social, economical, military forces that created that particular layout. And that always against the attitude of the Israeli army that sees building houses as strategic weapons. I mean, this, believe it or not, is a slide of an Israeli general who is the commander of the education corps of the Israeli army, which actually kind of says very clearly, Israel building houses as strategic weapons, right? We build here the settlements of Maale Edomim, east of Jerusalem, in order to create this wedge that cuts, you know, the kind of Palestinian continuity across the north-south axis of the West Bank. If Israeli architecture is represented as existing within clear forms, clear layout, with Palestinian architecture as a kind of formless sprawl that just has to be contained, no? That has to be put at bay. This general, as well as others, actually refer to Palestinian architecture as the jihad of building, right? What is the jihad of building? Where you have this kind of sprawl, uncontrolled sprawl. And that is almost like the nightmare of the Israeli army, the kind of the dense fabric of the Palestinian cities. Another kind of view of architecture as a in relation to violence, etc. On the left here you see an Israeli settlement. You know, I mean, most of you obviously know, and you see in the pictures, they always have those red roofs, no? And it has economic reasons as well for kind of giving the dream one single family house, but as well the military almost like orders settlements through their municipal sort of guidelines to put red roofs, because both from the air and from the ground, the military with a red roof can identify that is a settlement, right? So it kind of functioned as a military coordinate across a very confusing field. Only that when you create that sign, you know, you never know, you cannot control it. Here is a wall. It's not the main barrier for the West Bank, but just one of the many local ones. And a Palestinian city on the other side, what you see is that the Palestinians perceive very often the red roofs of the settlements actually as another thing, as a sign of progress, as a sign of kind of petit bourgeois luxury. And the houses most near it actually want to imitate that sign and put it over perfectly usable flat roofs and painted asbestos panels here. So you never know if it's a camouflage strategy or if it's a joke. I don't suppose so, but it's, you know, there's kind of a mimicry that operates across that field. Here again, a parade of Hamas, a jihadist group in Gaza, and their model of a settlement. Right, it's a part of models. Of icons, of presidents, of flags that they are produced by the Hamas-owned art department, and they are part of a kind of a voodoo ritual where they are to be burned as a kind of a symbol for the burning of the settlement. But look again how it is represented. It's the same kind of petit bourgeois, single-family house, the red, here pink roof, the little garden, the fence, etc., that architecture must burn, right? Or the model of architecture must burn as, you know, as kind of as this, as the main predicament of that conflict. You know, it's about architecture, and the violence is done to architecture. Here, when I was mentioning the analysis on the B'Tselem report and map, this is the main chapter in that report was about the city settlement of Ariel. This is Ariel. It's the biggest settlement in the West Bank. Second biggest. And we were asking ourselves, why does it look like it does? Why is it such a long and thin sausage? I mean, it's, you know, that the suburb want to be as compact, as round as possible. And just very briefly, through the incremental growth diagram that we've done for that report, you see how it started as two anchors, outposts, and kind of slowly closed that barrier that now starts with a new point here and will close a whole wedge across that axis, basically to cut the West Bank into two in that area again and separate the town of Salfit, which is a regional center, especially famous for oil production, from Zeta Jama'in, Kiryat Kfar Haris, which are villages to its north. The aim here, according to master plans, and this is something that is very much exemplified in Jerusalem, in very military strategy, wedging, no, putting army units between the enemy's army units. This is a kind of a thought of that, sort of the how. I didn't go very deeply into that, but when sort of a defensive matrix warfare always aim to bring in the enemy into it and then cut it apart, right? Cut in between it. The idea here is to limit Palestinian economy through chopping it up and to create forced migration. So we have here architecture as an act of transfer. This is very apparent in Jerusalem, for example, that we're not talking about now. Now we spoke only about building, but actually removing matter, removing bits of Palestinian cities is considered as act of planning in as much as building it. So destruction becomes a certain sort of creative act of redesigning the Palestinian city in a way that is much more convenient for the occupying army. This is something that with Aaron we did in the Cities Without a Citizen book. And here an analysis that is a little bit more in detail in that publication of the Battle of Jenin, where the Israeli military always claimed that the destruction of the center part of that refugee camp was an actual act of contingency. No, I mean, it was born out of the necessity of a very cruel battle, etc. Whereas what we were showing is that through that, even before the destruction of the central area, we have the widening of certain roads leading into the refugee camp, meaning the military was actually, here you see, cutting new roads through buildings in order to transfer and to transport its military inside it, so that there is an act. You cannot win, the military cannot win over Jenin without redesigning it. Right? Urban design is so important in terms of urban warfare that you can only win within a kind of a new organization of space. I'm passing it on to Rafi now, only in saying with this slide that another law that Rafi is going to explain now allowed, again, the fragmentation and the building of settlements on that matrix. What you see here is one regional council. It's the South Hebron Regional Council. It's again a map from the B'Tselem research that shows you all the pockets of law. These are Israeli enclaves within the Palestinian land. So, Rafi.
Yeah, okay. So to follow up on Amiral and to try to understand or explain a bit how these ideas, which were developed actually through military actions, are incorporated into civilian settlements and urban planning. So the map that we see here actually imagine a cut through a certain vertical level which circles or marks the areas which are then can be legally seized by the state in order for settlement activity to take place. And this is based on an Ottoman land law, which as the Ottomans were controlling this area for a long time. And Israel actually incorporates this land law, which says that land which is not cultivated for a certain number of years can be seized or taken by the state. So since the West Bank is a very mountainous region and has a lot of mountaintops, and naturally the land erodes from the mountaintops and the cultivated lands are in the valleys, so the mountaintops are left bare. And these bare mountaintops, these areas which are not cultivated, are actually marked here. So this is in a way the legal device which enables the state to seize these pockets, these stains, and then to use them for urban planning. Doesn't move. All right, okay. Now not only are spatial strategies influenced by the army, but also very practical tools. And here we have a diagram of a stereoscopic technique, which is a double lens camera, which actually takes two simultaneous aerial photo from the air, translated to a series of double photos, which then through an optical device reproduce a three-dimensional image of the land. And this is a very easy technique to map the whole land. Since when you take a regular aerial photo of a mountain's terrain, it's very difficult to understand what is high and what is low. And this technique enables immediately to understand the whole terrain, and then also to see what is cultivated and what is not. So in a few days, you can actually take all the aerial photos needed and then map the whole West Bank. So you see the barren hilltops are then made available for settlement activity. And if we look at this slide, for example, we see that here where we have olive groves and agriculture areas, these are cultivated by Palestinians. And this area, this rockier area, can be taken for use of settlements. And this begins to explain the forms that you've been seeing on the map. So an example in Efrat, which is a settlement in the West Bank, what you would first assume that these cultivations, this agriculture, actually belong to the people living here. They go out every morning and work the land, are actually the opposite, because these are Palestinian, this is an Israeli settlement. And the line of conflict is defined exactly between agriculture and building. But it's much more complex, since settlements use different techniques in a way to block in, like using a road here and beginning of buildings over here, to block area which is Palestinian, agriculture area, and not enable Palestinians to enter that. I mean, you have it here as well. You have it here as well. Another technique is using a pine plantation over here and over here. Since pine lets out an acid which does not allow the land to be useful for agriculture. So you see that actually settlements are just plain suburbs. They don't have, most of them do not have any agricultural base or do not have industry, but they're just sleepover dormitories. Now when these begin to occupy mountaintops, so we begin to see some kind of metrics of fortification, of settlements occupying the whole mountaintop on all sides. But in a way, many are placed near or on areas which crusade fortifications were. But these lack the physical fortification. And instead of walls, they're just houses. So the unit which establishes this civilian fortification is basically, at most, a single-family house. But how are these houses laid out? And here we began to see what we call this panoptic principle, which mainly stresses on this idea that settlements are used in a way as optical devices. They execute power through vision, but it's more complex. It's and this is taken from Foucault, which I'm sure most of you know, that power through vision, and vision is not only visible, but it is also unverifiable, meaning that from every point you can see the houses which are overlooking the landscape and overlooking the Palestinian towns, but you cannot verify if actually someone is here. And maybe it's not so important, but the actual existence, the actual presence of the house does that already for you. Now, a typical settlement would be organized with ring roads, equally divided lots and houses, usually around 500 square meters, and in the center, the communal buildings. That would be a synagogue, community center. And this is the most efficient and generic, I would say, organization of a settlement. And you see different versions of it here and here. But then the topography does not allow you always to organize that perfect circle. So the same architectural and urban planning principles are adopted according to the topography. Over here. And here we have a series of master plans of settlement layouts. And you see some are actually from that Labor Party time, which is between 67 and 77, which were built in the valley, and they were more agricultural. So you have this one, for example, here. But the others, you begin to see these strange forms, which can really, which are not your typical urban planning schemes, and in many examples are totally unpredicted, but echo in plan actually the lines of topography So we would read here that this Ali, for example, has two peaks sitting on a mountain. Or you can begin to read how the topography can be seen through this plan of Gvaot. Now, if these settlements are organized as optical devices, then the question raises as to what are we seeing from these streets, from these settlements. And here we have a series of a drive-through, the inner road, and you get this axial view towards the landscape, and it's actually a repeated view that creates a whole panorama around the landscape. And here I'd like to quote a verdict from the High Court Justice supporting the legality, because this is in reaction to an appeal actually claiming that the settlements were civilian, and then according to the Geneva Code, the occupying power is not allowed to send this population to occupying land. So when I quote from the verdict, with respect to pure military considerations, there is no doubt that the presence of settlements, even if civilian, of the occupying power in the occupied territory substantially contributes to the security in that area and facilitates the execution of the duties of the military. So this is clearly linking it to military use. And I continue. One does not have to be an expert in military and security affairs to understand that terrorist elements operate more easily in an area populated only by an indifferent population or one that supports the enemy, as opposed to an area in which there are persons who are likely to observe them and inform the authorities about any suspicious movement. Among them, no assistance or equipment would be provided to terrorists. The matter is simple and details are unnecessary. So the state clearly sees the role of settlers as another arm of its security power. But then the question is, do settlements come to the West Bank to observe Palestinians? Well, why are settlers coming? I mean, clearly they are coming for the landscape. Clearly they are coming to view something, to look at something. And here we bring examples from brochures promoting or advertising settlements. This one on the left of Emmanuel, published in Brooklyn. And it says here in Hebrew, a town which is a home. And I will quote from this brochure. The city of Emmanuel, situated 440 meters above sea level, has a magnificent view of the coastal plain and the Judean mountains. The hilly landscape is dotted by green olive orchards and enjoys a pastoral calm. And here on the right, it says, here's my home in the city, in the land of Benjamin. So here the landscape actually works as a totally different idea. It is a means, it reenacts some kind of identity. It is the means where settlers can come back to the biblical landscape, to the landscape of their forefathers. So it is used, and of course through the windows of modernity like in other colonial traditions. So it is used in a way to redefine their true identity, to bring them back to the land that actually is theirs. But here, there is a paradox, and it is a paradox of a vision, since settlers are coming for this biblical landscape, for the olive trees, for the stone houses, for the terraces. But they're actually this landscape is actually created by the Palestinians, which are excluded from the view. And on the other side, while they are actually there in order to enjoy this beautiful landscape, they are also in a way hijacked by the state to observe the Palestinians, which are then excluded from the view. So there is a paradox in a very complex situation regarding this vision. Another element which has to do, again, with construction and destruction, you can see here the bulldozer, which this is a brochure promoting settlement activity, and the bulldozer here is immediately associated with progress and with the building of settlement. But the same bulldozer, which is a civilian tool, is not as a tank, is easily used also for destruction, if in the case of olive trees or in the case of houses. Here is a drawing that, one of the drawings we did in order to draw all these sight lines and to see how it actually works. And a more detailed drawing we did on the area of Ariel, which Eyal talked about earlier, and this is the city of Ariel here. And there's a computer-generated drawing which actually all the black lines mark the lines of sight, meaning the areas which are visible from the city of Ariel here, the white. And all the black spots are Palestinian towns and villages. And the white area, the area which is out of the field of vision. So you can see in a way how this field of vision creates a net which all the Palestinian, most of the Palestinian towns are actually in this net. I'm just going to show a series of aerial photos done by through Shalom Achshav, through Peace Now, by Milutin Rabidovich, and these are aerial of this series was taken in 2002. This is quite handy, huh? So you see, for example, Har Choma. Actually, the condition that is in January 2003 was like that in 2001 already. So this is what happens to Har Choma south of Jerusalem in a period of 4 years. And settlements are actually creating this network. They are connected through roads, they are connected to each other. One can see one settlement for the other settlement. And they, in a very minimum way, by taking the summits, actually control the whole terrain. And all this effort in infrastructure to get another branch of possible development, of possible, this is just an outpost, but it is already here, you see, laid out for future houses. In Male Adumim, which is the biggest in the West Bank. Ramallah and Psagot. And you clearly see the architecture, an architecture of conflict. Yeah. And I'll let Eyal continue from here.
So it seems that now the way that the built environment aspect of the conflict is very much to do with the barrier through the West Bank, and again, we showed you how the frontier has been created and how it's been constructed and operated, and now is it being actually closed, by the barrier? I mean, when I say barrier, The reasons for it is that there's been a lot of discussion in regards to how to call that thing. You know, the Israelis like to call it a fence. It makes one think of neighbors, good or not good. Palestinians call it a wall or the apartheid wall. But somehow, before we decide how to call something that is in 95% of its way actually a fortification system that looks more like that on the right, one has to understand that the fence is not more benign than a wall, right? A fence is a fence because it continues exactly the panopticon function of the occupation that Rafi was describing. You know? Fence is there to be watched through, to look at the Palestinian through it. When you analyze the path of the barrier, you see that it's always on the part of the slope over the Palestinian village or town, a fence you can see through and shoot through. And the wall is actually positioned in location where there's a dense built fabric that one needs to separate. Well, I think that by now you know what the kind of the fortification system is made of. It's a series of fences for most of its length here. When I was saying it's on the side of the slope facing the Palestinian, you can see it. And an anti-tank ditch. When I was going along the barrier and asking the contractor, a very suburban construction company that is, formerly was doing the paving for all the suburbs in Israel, Ackerstein, I was like, why do you build a tank barrier? Exactly. He said, oh, you don't know whatever may come. It's a kind of... a little bit about the history of it, you know that it's built from north to south, you know? And you probably know as well that it was born as a labor project, right? It was created as a result of the collapse of the labor project in peace project in Camp David. No, Barak said, okay, if we cannot get an agreed upon border, we will construct unilaterally a border. And what Barak had in mind is something more or less on the green line. And that is the way the barrier actually started. If you see the areas up, do you have a pointer? Yeah. If you see the areas here, literally the barrier follows the green line. But to understand the nature of the barrier, we have to understand that the path of it, because it kind of snakes down. It wasn't first designed completely and then built. It sort of snakes down. It starts embodying at any given moment the balance, the political balance of forces on it. So imagine actually that the barrier, the part of the barrier is a diagram of Israeli society in any given, you know, point in time and in space. You know? So that the part of the barrier is a result of all the vectors of push and pull. Finally, kind of, that is the balance of forces. This is how we're going to build it. So as it starts kind of snaking down, it goes through a process of political positive feedback. Now, what it means? Every complaint, every sort of action that is or requested and being leveled at the government is being amplified by counterversions, right? So the kind of the Israeli political system start accommodating as well the settlers, environmentalists, archaeologists, agriculturists, hydrologists, aviation experts. Everybody wants to, you know, his kind of effect on the wall. No? So it stopped being only sort of a military barrier, but for example, they find 10 archaeological sites on the path. And 10 times they amend the barrier to include it in the Israeli side. No? And once Israeli conservationists, and there was around here, actually around that area, it's a rare flower is growing. No? It's an iris. That they actually kind of made that nook in the in the barrier in order to include it. So slowly it sort of start accommodating all these influences, and those start amplifying itself themselves. So you see that as it goes southward, it kind of it goes more and more and more deep inside and kind of starts to behave in a more unpredictable way. I mean, here is just a few images as well. When the settler lobby actually start adopting that project, they start using it for their own means. When the military start realizing, hey, by building the barrier here, we can actually gain, you know, kill another bird. Here, for example, the Palestinian Parliament building in Abu Dis, which is another interesting story, built through donations from the EU. You see literally the car park of that building, it's not finished, it's been used to store the prefabricated elements of the wall. So in a sense, you know, a kind of a direct sort of physical, you know, to communicate their aggression to the political Palestinian system. Here another example, I'll just go briefly. This wealthy settlement, very wealthy, perhaps the wealthiest settlement, Alfeim and Ashe, in the first configuration of the barrier, should have actually gone out of the West Bank to a road here, which they didn't like very much. They lobbied to the government to go on using that. Therefore, the government actually completely trapped Qalqilya, the whole Palestinian town within a wall, separated from Khabla, which is literally the same town, no? Cut them apart. Today, if you are a resident of Khabla, you have to travel 20 miles to Qalqilya around here. Just that the settlers of Alfeim and Ashe could travel safely on the same route they have been doing so far. So there's all these moments where the military logic of the barrier fails. At some point, and when I was describing those political forces that are operating on those lines, and as they became more and more and more intense, as more people lobbied, as more settlers, and they became so contradictory, the path of the barrier could no longer accommodate all those pressures. And basically what it did, it shred up. So if you kind of understand the barrier as a continuous line, and as it was at the beginning of the project, one continuous line that snakes and meander through Palestinian territory, but still a line, it can no longer be understood like that. Because settlers that were left behind complained so much that now bits of the barrier are actually kind of almost like splintered walls, no? They're cut out and just surround them like islands within Palestinian area. And Palestinian left on the Israeli side of the barrier are islands, Palestinian islands within Israeli area. So we have a kind of a whole sort of deep field across which Palestinians and Israeli meet, and the barrier is just the meeting point between them. Again, the return of the frontier, right? And so I think that this is answering that issue. This is a Palestinian island where these cars cannot travel anywhere outside of the village where they are. And here, a kind of a momentary balance of it. When one thinks about the barrier and the way that it constantly adapt to change and to pressures, well, American political pressure, European political pressure, all these are actually operating on its path. One sees a landscape which reminds much more of a kind of a Norwegian fjords with fjords, islands, and lakes, no? That are not exactly a kind of we are here, you are there, but a complete fragmentation of the territory. And here, this insane sort of close-up where on this map is marked each and every barrier that is built through a 20-kilometer square. What you see in blue is the fences around settlements themselves. Red dots are the roadblocks. The brown are actually ways of grouping of Palestinian villages, usually with earth mounds or ditches. Here is the main barrier, projected, not yet constructed. Here is the constructed main barrier. You see that basically the barrier is not an object but a condition. It's a condition of complete enclosure. Right? We cannot understand it as one thing. And we cannot understand that as a border between two states. I think that the Adi Ophir and Ariella Azoulay made this point very, very, very clearly and well when they wrote about the temporality of the conflict. They said that to argue for the temporality of the conflict allows us, or allows Israeli, to perpetuate a state of emergency and to operate outside its normal laws, whereas the situation of permanent, right, the situation of normality does not allow it. I mean, it's a point borrowed from Giorgio Agamben, actually, when he speaks about the camp. No, the camp is the place of exception, whereas the West Bank is full of those zones of indistinction, right, where the actual definition of the occupation as a temporary situation allowed that temporariness, and allowing that temporariness to be perpetuated now for 37 years allows us to always modify the landscape temporarily, obviously. So we have temporary roadblocks and temporary barriers and temporary settlements and temporary military installation, and everything is temporary, temporary assassination and temporary arrests. You know, and that thing is all, this is Israeli defense in the international court as well, on the barrier. It's a temporary military arrangement. It's so temporary that at some point barriers and borders are so temporary that at some point in April 2002, you remember, this is the Mukata, which is Arafat's headquarters. The border between the only area that was left of the Palestinian Authority was that one that is marked here in red. No, it's Arafat's compound. The rest was occupied. The rest was under Israeli control. At some point, they destroyed that bridge, right? You remember that, with the bulldozer kind of chipping at the building. And the interior of the room of Arafat's office was the border between Israel and Palestine. No, it kind of shrank into the dimension of interior design almost. So, you know, borders are temporary, and they shrink and expand. And here are all their manifestations, earth dike, roadblock, etc. Here, again, not the main barrier, but a barrier around the settlement of Gilo, and we say settlement of the neighborhood, although it's defined as neighborhood by Israel, it's on occupied land. Rafi was speaking about the pastoral, biblical, and what when the pastoral landscape starts shooting back at you? No? So you build a barrier, and you draw on the barrier the same landscape you bought, actually, when you bought your apartment, no? Best view to the, how do you say, pastoral calm? Yeah. So you draw the landscape, but you cleanse the Palestinian of it, right? I mean, it's beautiful, empty, biblical, without the jihad of building. Now, this situation of the frontier has been, it's like contiguous disease, no? So the idea of gating and fortification is now transformed into Israel proper, no? Because we have attacks within Israeli cities, etc. So now everything is, you know, as the border is everywhere in the West Bank, the border is everywhere within Israel, around every shopping mall, housing estate, between different Palestinian Israelis and Palestinian and Israeli Jews, etc. In cities that were joined before, only that image is actually taken from South Africa. It's an image by Lindsay Brenner that actually shows us that we are not talking about a situation which is very different, right? A situation of, I think that what that shows is somehow that the condition of the frontier, right, where the border is everywhere. Where, you know, when we had this kind of this process of erosion of national borders, no, and kind of flow that is happening, actually the border popped up in every place, no, and kind of the model to understand as well, perhaps our own urbanism is much more closer to the idea of the frontier now as well. Here again, another example, again South Africa, on the way that those barriers work on different scales. And perhaps just to finish that lecture, how do you move across a landscape which is completely fragmented into islands. No, you see, if we're talking about peninsulas now rather than surfaces, if that is our geographical imagination, the way to move across it here and developed in The Politics of Verticality, which is an article I wrote, is the bridge which is under Israeli sovereignty. It's Area C, if you know. The valley, it's Area B, it's under Palestinian sovereignty. The international border runs between the column and the road, yeah, here. So before we had it down to the interior design, here we have it down to the technical. We have Israel over Palestine. Meron Benvenisti is calling it the breaking of three dimension into six, three Israeli and three Palestinians. Here the road goes into the depth of the earth, which is Israeli, where the top of the mountain is Palestinian, right? We have here Bejala. So we have Israel under Palestine. So we have a kind of a whole three-dimensional arrangement where the conflict takes place. Now, like, two dimensions are not enough to resolve that conflict based on the politics of separation. It's gone so far, the insanity of that frontier, of that fragmentation, demands, for example, the generous plan of Barack and Clinton in Camp David, right? 40 tunnels and bridges in Jerusalem connecting the Palestinian islands to themselves. How do you move from one island? I mean, do you need a passport to go from one neighborhood to the next? No, take a bridge. I mean, here the example is even more apparent. What you have here, according to the Clinton-Barack plan that Arafat angrily and unjustifiably rejected, is that the Palestinians were given the plate, right? This Al-Aqsa Mosque and Haram al-Sharif, up to the depth of the paving stones, right? That's a Palestinian. Underneath it will be a meter and a half of UN space, which will guard, and Israel will have the depth of the mound, everything underneath that, supposedly the remnants of the temple. The air, the sky, is Israeli, right? It's holy sky. So what we have is Israel, UN, Palestine, Israel, right? The border taking a complete sort of vertical dimension. And when the Palestinians say, how do you expect us to get there? You know, completely wrapped up in Israel, you know, left, right, up and above, they propose a pedestrian bridge over the graveyard here, that you know it's a sacred graveyard. It's a Palestinian pedestrian bridge that would connect to their kind of isolated floating plate. And that's the kind of landscape we're supposed to live with. As well, obviously, you know, that when one speaks about the bigger scale, we have both the air and here all the aerial routes over Israel-Palestine that I think nobody can take apart. You know, I mean, it's like, how can you partition an air over such a small territory, you know? And as well, what people must realize that both Israel and Palestine, and around here would be the Green Line, are sitting on this one huge water lake, underground water, called the mountain aquifer, that cannot be partitioned. So somehow you cannot partition the subterranean, not the air, and as well not the surface. So with that kind of issue, I think with that failure of the politics of separation that started from the clear, I mean, if you remember, you trace back the lecture, started with the clear line along the Suez Canal, now this very clear dike, and started to dissolve into the points, and from the points into the matrix, and from the matrix into the barriers, and from the barriers into the roads and tunnels, from the road and tunnel into the aqua, da, 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 da. It's kind of a Talmudic chain of reductum ad absurdum of this logic that kind of keeps on, needs to perpetuate through ever more insane and bizarre infrastructure. We're left with a situation that we cannot partition anymore, and then we ask you what to do. So thank you very much, and perhaps we take questions. What we can leave it, and if people want to refer to an image. We can.
I think in Israeli culture, in Israeli society, this role of the citizen as a security person is actually it's part of a wider educational system. I mean, it is very natural in a way for Israeli citizens to become security personnel. In a way, we Israelis are from an early age taught to look out for suspicious objects. Because the army is the army of the people. Everyone has to serve. All Israeli Jews have to serve in the army. So this idea of security is integrated into the citizen, into the role of the citizen. So by nature, it is a very easy. I mean, it's very difficult to separate between military and civilian in many ways. And so it is a very natural role of the citizen that the citizen takes on as actually watching for state security. So in a way, in terms of Israeli society, you can imagine a condition that settlers would not question, in a way, their security role, because it is obvious, it is part of their role as citizens to be aware of security. Yes, the politics of verticality was a work, was an article by Eyal, and together we organized an exhibition called The Civilian Occupation, which the material of the exhibition is in the book. And the exhibition was intended, was actually commissioned by the Association of Israeli Architects, and intended to go on to this international congress. And 2 weeks before, it was intended to show it was banned by them. So clearly the reaction from the professional organizations representing the architects in Israel is clear, stating that, and their claim was that at first this was not architecture, and architecture is a pure profession and it doesn't have to do anything with politics. But worldwide, I think we got a lot of positive feedbacks. In terms of our work, it did damage our work in Israel.
I mean, we don't have any more work in Israel. She asked whether we were thinking of translating the theoretical analysis into an activist position, and you know, I mean, we think that what we do, no, I mean, because it's not only lectures and publication, we do exhibitions, etc. We try to even do it in Israel. It will open. It will open in Israel in We will see. It's supposed to. We're still talking about it. But this, we feel that is the best way for us to channel our talents, you know, into doing that. I mean, we do go for demonstrations from time to time, but it's not. I think that as architects, we feel that right now the idea of opposition or refusing, you know, the architect refusing, is probably a stronger than a kind of an active architectural role to do that, because anyway, anything you do now, you'd work within the framework of the occupation. When there is no occupation anymore, when there is one state, when there's Palestinian state, etc., then we can see what we can do. But to work under the occupation, even for humanitarian reasons, we have a big problem. I mean, it's always the paradox of humanitarian help, you know, that is, in a sense, it's the decent thing and this is what you want to do. On the other hand, it always tend to serve the occupying country, you know. I mean, for example, I remember when Sharon first talked about his partition plan, you know, when he first mentioned the word occupation. It was a very big moment in Israel, and he was saying to his cabinet, to his right-wing cabinet ministers, you know, there are 3.5 million Palestinians under our occupation, and do you know that 1.8 million of them are actually receiving, actually only survive based on humanitarian aid? And he said, do you actually want to take that over? Do you know how much it would cost us? And when he says it, you go like, hold on for a second. So the people that are paying for this humanitarian, all these millions and Japanese EU money that is propping up the people there just to, so they're healthy enough to be occupied, who are they actually serving, no? If Israel is actually fearing to take over that, I mean, if Israel would have to pay for it, it will retreat immediately. That will be the reason for withdrawal. So finally, there is this paradox that while working under occupation, you have to be very careful. Especially in humanitarian context. It's called humanitarian paradox. Right? So, yeah.
I was very wrong. I suppose you were going to speak about the sentiment of giving. Fine. I listened to you, and I have said certain words. You have your point of view about the politics. Fine. But I find so many local in your arguments, starting beginning with the first one, only the first one. The other kind of I'm going to leave it for another discussion. You said Barrio, life was a stupidity, they made a burn of sand, so forth. It was a continuous line, like Van Maginot said there. Your arguments, yes. Remember, Barrio, life was not a continuous line. It was a burn made of sand with the Arabs. Pump, provided by Germany, had pressure pump, 26 pounds bar, it means, okay. They destroyed this bar, but the fortification was 6 or 10 or 15 kilometers between them, and every fortification has about 15 soldiers and have a special road, you know, this road was made
artillery
just
road,
to
yeah.
go with the truck to provide them. So, excuse me, sir. In the Second World War, BBC transmitted every day, and they said, if we are going to be forced, or let's say in splendid terms, if you are not going to die, and somebody, if the people is going to fight a lie, immediately they are going not to deliver any more from us. So, if you believe in your organization, with certain point of view, which absolutely you cannot deny them, I am true, and even one of the fortifications remained, after the end of this war.
Yes, Budapest,
right.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. Sir. And don't ask me about Dini Maginot, if you can see it, we can talk about. So every point of view makes ridiculization of everyone, laughing about everyone. You never consider the one other point of view. When you saw your mouth, you discussed one part of the mouth. You didn't discuss the second. You said the second one was like point, like grain of salt and the food. And you did the same. Why the other part didn't have the second was not together? They were also dispersed because the topography of the plate or the place asked you So I would like to listen something absolutely open and to consider God for you, not to be so ridiculized, so strongly ridiculized, to
be an argument
which could not stand clean and normal.
What is your question?
My question is,
yes,
you are saying a lot of things which are not exactly from the point of view of architecture, of logic, of technical point of view. You are using your sentiment, your point of sensitivity, in certain political situations, you know.
I understood the question now, and I thank you very much for it. Especially, I think that useful were the addition on the Berlev line. I know you refer to Mausim, yeah, to those points that were on the water line, spaced out at 15 kilometers apart, right? These were the strongholds. I don't think that anybody in the Israeli high command would deny that the Berlev line is a linear fortification. Even the Tot line or the Maginot line was, there were strongholds, but along the line. Okay, so I mean I'm not arguing against that, and I think it, and I probably will value your knowledge. We can talk about it later. I think that obviously our analysis comes from, you know, it's a spatial analysis, and we try to be as kind of as scientific as possible, but within our political belief. There's no deny on that we come from a particular sort of critical point of view. I don't think that it is our role to embody the balance in ourselves, right? If Aaron thinks now that was a bit too much, he could get a Palestinian to say the Palestinian side. I think that finally, that is a position of any, I think, writer that is writing from his own position. And I hope that you will be invited next time and you will give your position. So I think that it's enough perhaps to deal with that question now. And I will be very happy to speak to you later. So, yes, thank you.
You never directly addressed the intent that you stated, the government's intent that you stated, the development. Do you feel that from the start of the complete matrix plan reflects a continuity of intent up until today with the Greek party plan? Or do you feel that this has been sort of made on an ad hoc basis and has sort of changed more organically?
Okay.
Okay, so maybe this needs a wide explanation regarding architecture. So most of settlements and most of the slides that we showed, and all of the settlement towns, are a result of what we call, in professional terms, master planning. And the master planning is not only relates to a certain built area, but also to its municipal boundaries, and furthermore to its regional boundaries. And the first master plan for the whole of West Bank was written in 78. It's the Drobles master plan. And these are guidelines, how you build. Yes, where you build, how you build according to what. And drawings for the settlements are pre-planned, pre-prepared on a table, speculating and designing the whole area of expansion. Now, what we see and what we heard of in the last years are what we call outposts. And some of these outposts are actually not planned, but very events that are taking place. Immediately, a group of youngsters goes out, grabs a hill, puts a few caravans. But there are different techniques, different ways to settle areas. But the majority of the settlement as a project is pre-planned. It's preconceived and pre-planned, pre-drawn.
Excuse me?
Would the ultimate goal be annexation or just permanent occupation?
Yeah. Can I take one? Yeah, you can
continue. Yeah, I think that there were many interests that went into the populate this skeletal project that was put in place immediately by Sharon. Sharon's technique initially, when he was, Droblas did the master plan under him, was to create settlements as outposts, no, that and roads between them. There were no settlements yet. There were just seeds. Now, in order to get the population into those seeds and to put flesh on that matrix, he needed allies in the Israeli society. So, and he was using existing trends that were there. There were the people of Gush Emunim we were not talking about. This is an NGO. It's probably the strongest NGO. And this is a messianic organization that that wanted to settle the biblical land. No, then there was another sort of pressure within Israeli society, one of suburbanization. No? There was not much suburbanized area around Tel Aviv, or it was very expensive. No, so finally he had to speak all languages in order to channel all these forces into his matrix that was planned. So there is many ways to actually read that history. If a person by Gush Emunim, maybe responding to the previous question, would agree to give a lecture here, he would say that they actually created the settlement project. The settlement project is actually based on, you know that in the frontier, traditionally, the political balance is at the edge, not at the center, no? By kind of semi-independent groups. Usually religious or very ideological, not that they're actually pulling the politics of the center. And this is how the people of Gush Emunim perceive it. You know, that they actually got this kind of posthumous verification of their project. I think that from the point of view of the military history, which is very much the point of view that the analysis of Sharon and that comes to, it's the master plan and the population of the master plan through these branches of society. But again, there are many stories. You can tell it from many directions.
I have a technical question, and that was impressive, the mapping section. The GIS parcel-based map. I was wondering to what extent you have a configuration of a website, who's maintaining that, and the work of those before, I think, are critical technical tool of architects designing urban designs and urbanism. Mm-hmm. Where do you get your data? Do you collect your own data? Is that available for the state?
The map that was done with B'Tselem is based on several sort of sources of information, and one very important one we have to admit was the CIA office in Tel Aviv. CIA office in Tel Aviv has interest in the work of peace NGOs in Israel, right? I don't know why, or I can guess why, but they provide us with fresh satellite images that were not good enough. Therefore, we had to take aerial tours and based or receive the aerial archive from Peace Now, which you've seen now, from which we actually drew the form of all the settlements. Moreover, we had to drive to most of them and to collect those outline plans that you've seen. These are the plan of the settlement itself. Initially, they are supposed to be under the public domain, no? I mean, because they're planning documents, they're legal documents, they have to be open to sort of a due process of objection, etc. Only that Israel do not want to involve the Palestinian in the process of objection. Therefore, when the law says you have to publish that there is an outline plan pending in three newspapers, They publish in three Hebrew newspapers that Palestinians don't read. Furthermore, in order to object, the Palestinians have to enter the settlement, right? And they can't enter. Furthermore, it's very expensive, and as well they can. So, I mean, these are kind of, there's different sort of fogs that make that process very opaque.
The actual, the settlements themselves, you show us pictures of the single family homes with the red roofs. They're sitting on a parcel, and that parcel is owned by the residents, where they are one state.
It's owned by the state and leased. Yeah, leased for 99 years plus 99 years plus. Yeah, but 90% of land in Israel, also within the Green Line or without or outside the Green Line, whichever way you call it, is state land.
Very much illegal. That's another question. We spoke about your political motivation representing the thesis, but I was wondering, from a strictly architectural point of view, is it wrong to build a settlement on a map dot that is uncapitated, or is uncultivated, especially when you pointed out the absurdity of separation? So what if we have a settlement that is next door to a Palestinian village? Even if it looks from an architectural point.
I think it's a very good question. I think the question is, what's wrong with building settlements if you are building them on an uncultivated hilltop and it doesn't actually harm, I suppose you meant in a condition that it's not creating a wedge or something like that, and it doesn't really harm the area, can just perhaps provide more income. That really depends under what political model you work, right? If you work under a political idea of separation, partitioning, and you understand that wherever you'll have the settlement, finally the border will run, you would say perhaps a bad thing about it would be that it would create land grab, as you see with the barrier that kind of wraps up the settlement. If you work from a one-state paradigm and you just say, let's liberalize sort of, you know, the housing land market, you have to liberalize it in both ways. And if you do, and at the time that you do that, and it's very far away, you'd say every Palestinian refugee or citizen of Israel or Palestinian living in the West Bank can live in Israel on state land, can purchase it whenever he wants, fine. You know now that both in settlements and in suburbs, community suburbs, in Israel, Palestinians cannot buy land, right? They're barred from it because the land belonged to the Jewish people, not to the Palestinians. Right, through different mechanisms. Now, if you liberalize it, there's no problem. But let's get there to the situation where you can sort of allow market forces to act freely across the terrain. Then I would accept it. There's nothing wrong in it.
I'm not sure exactly how to frame the question, I'm really interested in the question of militarism in Israel as something that the peace movement here in the United States should be talking about in order to help people understand what's actually going on. And I guess, like, you kind of suggested at the beginning of your presentation that the planning for settlement construction was motivated by these sort of, like, technical military arguments about whether you should have a border, whether you should have a line or a matrix in order to defend territory. But I guess I'm wondering, like, how much do you think that, say, the transition from the Alon plan to the later Likud plans was actually about, like, some well-reasoned, like, military argument versus how much was it, you know, a different military concept that was chosen because it matched a different ideology? Like, we had a different set of allies and a different way of understanding the political priorities of the Israeli government, and so a total, you know, a different military concept went along with it. But it doesn't seem to me like it's really a technical question in any way. And, you know, because you could easily make a military argument that none of it was necessary. You didn't need the line on the Suez Canal. You didn't need any of it. People said, like, we would rather keep Sharm el-Sheikh than have peace. So there's always another military argument to be made. So
well, that's political, not military. what you just said is more political than military. But
yeah.
But I understand the question. And it's important to understand that the role here, or what Eyal was talking about, is the influence of military actions on a spatial conception in terms of strategy. And this is important influence. Of course, the shift from settlements of the Alon Plan, which are agriculturally based, to settlements which are on the mountaintop, which are actual suburbs. This is another shift from a more agricultural society towards a more towards a structure of sleepover suburbs and people commuting to the cities. So there are a lot of processes going there, which actually the West Bank and this movement and the motivation behind settlements, if comparing the first 10 years of labor, which actually constructed between 10 and 15 settlements, and the next 10 years of Likud, which constructed over 100 settlements. So there is a totally different motivation and a totally different context and, I would say, social condition which allows this to flourish. And so it's not a technicality in terms, it's not a technical thing in terms of military action, but what we can see as the military is a kind of experimentation field, which the ideas were worked out first, several years before, in the 73 war, yes? And then how they influence and how they fit into this whole conception of settlement project.
Your model of the relationship between politics and space is absolutely fascinating and very interesting. There seems to be an element which is missing, at least in the presentation, which I'd like to raise for you, and that is, of course, the element of economic flows. None of this works unless there are ways of supporting settlers, that settlers can commute from their suburbs to places of work, that the opportunity costs of living in the settlement are greater than the risks and the expenses of traveling very winding roads and extremely complicated sort of networks of security and safety. So that from the point of view of the economic development of Israel, there must be a completely different set of logics which are at work here, which complicate the matter even more. And you haven't mentioned that, but I wonder what the reasoning is on that level.
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you very much for raising this very important point. You know, I mean, the lecture was already an hour and 20 minutes. And, I mean, whoever wants, there's a whole chapter on that in Land Grab, which is on B'Tselem's homepage, and that develops it. I mean, obviously, you're right through and through. There was a whole mechanism that basically related mathematically danger to financial assistance, you know? So the more danger you're willing to take on, I mean, because you said, right? I mean, you have to get enough money to pay for the danger that you... So they had they basically had three lines that they made through the West Bank. Said, okay, the western suburb, anyway, it's a great area. The air there is fantastic. The view is superb. It's very close to Tel Aviv. You see the sea. Let's give them 15%, right? As you go further in, we're talking about 25%. When you go to the valley, or really, if you're willing to settle almost like inside the Palestinian city, it's much more. And the interesting thing is that what we have written about in the B'Tselem report is that the Israeli government tried to hide the actual amount of money that they actually subsidized settlements with, through putting it never, there isn't a category in the budget like assistance to settlement, no? It kind of spread in between road construction and amusement park and tax breaks, which are across the board. So, I mean, you have to be a very good accountant to actually fish them out, and some people yeah. did it. And we relied on that logic. So there's, and it was always like, okay, if people would know how much of their tax money is actually going to subsidize people who are wealthier than them, because the people in the West Bank are relatively, you know, I mean, they're upper middle class. In Israeli terms, here it'll be lower middle class.
But that reliance on infrastructure is essential to have a very strong, I mean, a very developed infrastructure. And one of the conditions of the US aid to Israel is that the money would be used for infrastructure. So it also makes sense in a way.
The question is, how do these people live? That's all outgoing. Where does the state hope in some way to recoup this vast, bottomless investment in infrastructure and in effect bribes to get people to live in these places? Is there any plan for making these things economically viable?
Well, I mean, they're commuting, you know, you go to Tel Aviv and to Jerusalem, they work, they're summer.
No, he says, where's the income? where's the revenue?
US foreign policy.
Exactly.
I can't say that, you know.
Exactly.
Well, thank you. Yeah.